Troy, when you were doing some of the testing with the 4-7, tell us what you were trying to accomplish, what envelope you would push to see if it would do this or that, and so on.
Well, so RSP is obviously, you didn't mention it in the 1-2-3-4, so it's a...
It was in there.
It's called a long
week. It's a
2.5,
right? And it's about half. You see how much shorter it is on the model there. So that there was a number of reasons we selected that particular aircraft, but the idea was to put as large of a telescope mirror in an airplane as we could, and so we were looking for a 3-meter mirror, and we ended up with the 2.5, pretty close. And flying an aircraft that fast and that high with a open cavity in the back, so we have about a 10-foot hole that we cut in there, is no simple task. And there's been some pretty spectacular failures at such things in the past and other programs, and so we were very concerned that we were going to maybe this wouldn't work. You can see where the hole is, so on that model, and it could affect a lot of things, directional and longitude.
I'll get back to you in a minute on that. Joe, you were with the shuttle, and you were doing the testing with the shuttle on top of a 747. Talk a little bit about that, what you were trying to accomplish. I always thought the only time you saw the shuttle on top of a 4-7 is when a crane came along, put it up on the plane, took it to where it was going, got off, took the crane, took it down. I was wrong.
Well, I think the primary incentive for mounting the space shuttle on top of the 747 was to recover it if the space shuttle had landed other than Kennedy Space Center, where the launch facilities are. Transporting the airplane from wherever it had to land, if it had an emergency landing or if weather caused it to divert, was a real problem. And the easiest thing was to airlift it back down to Florida and at Kennedy, where the launch facilities were, and then mount, refly it from there. A number of airplanes were considered. In fact, the C-5 was considered, It finally decided that this was just a rugged piece of machinery that could take all the additional turbulence and the vibrations that would be involved in carrying the space shuttle on top of the 747 as such. So initially it was designed to bring it back from an emergency landing field back to Kennedy or transport it wherever you needed to transport it. And then we looked at that and decided, you know, if we could fly it off the top of the 747 and clear the tail without taking the tail off, which would have been kind of an inappropriate thing to do.
Inconvenient.
That's a better, more tactful. These guys are so tactful, I hate to get in front of them. That we could get we could fly it on days that we wanted to. We'd pick our day when there was good weather, fly it at Edwards over the dry lake bed, lined up and separate the space shuttle from the 747, and then glide test it down. Check out the flight control system, see if there's any, and the picture of the monitor is up there now, see if there was any concerns or problems. Turns out we found out some real problems, like saturating the hydraulic system when you get down close to the ground.
You don't start the shuttle when you're flying along to release, to get off that 747. Do you have blast bolts that knock off so you can take off, so to speak?
Do we have what? I'm sorry.
Blast bolts? How did you release off the 747?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm terribly sorry.
It's okay. We're both hard of hearing.
We had three explosive bolts, and if you look at the picture on the screen, well, what was on the screen, there's the two in the rear that came up and attached to the main gear doors, or the structure around the main gear, and then one up on the nose. And the one on the nose, interestingly enough, could be raised and lowered to change the incidence angle between the 747 and the shuttle so that on the captive flights, Fitz could take it up and see, is there enough tension, is there enough lift to fly the thing away before it slides back and takes off the tail. So we learned an awful lot from that system. It was an exciting program, too.
I was kidding about both of us being hard of hearing. You should have heard us in the back before we started. I don't know who was yelling more. Joe and I, never mind. Anyway, I want to get back to you, Troy, with the testing. We hear about test pilots all the time. What when you take a bird like this up, what are you testing for? Does Boeing tell you, or do you as a test pilot have your own parameters that you say, this is what I'm going to try, this is what I'm going to do, blah, blah, blah?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That was a good answer.
So yeah, we started out with about 3,000 test points, and from all different sources, from our own aerodynamicists to Boeing to FAA, to try to tell us what best way to test it. The joke amongst all of us back then was this was going to be the world's largest dog whistle, because when you open that door, you know, you can see who knows what's going to happen, and acoustic vibrations and resonance and all of that. Nobody really knew whether it was going to rip off one of the stabilators or maybe damage the rudder. Maybe we needed a larger rudder. So those are the kinds of things we really looked at. Where are we going to have catastrophic damage? Was the turbulence in the cavity going to be too much for that highly accurate telescope? And could we fly the airplane, or would we damage it grossly?
What did happen when you tried that?
Nothing.
Nothing.
It was amazing.
No hiccups, huh?
Not a one. The engineering that went into the design of that door, it was amazing. And one thing I learned pretty quickly was that the door, all of those bumps you see, and that is not a fairing covering up like rivets. That everything you see there has a purpose, and the shape of it exactly, the front, the back, the sides, everything is perfectly engineered to keep the flow along the boundary layer attached to the airplane until it's time to go right over that cavity and go off the back, and you do not feel a thing when that door opens.
You have tested a lot of aircraft over your career. I think you said 40, if it was something like that. Where does this one rank?
Well, the program ranks.
Remember,
right,
a Boeing guy is sitting next to you.
It ranks right up there with the B-2, so I'd put it right up there, about number one. It was what we had to do with this program. As an Air Force guy, I never seemed to be able to finish a test program because they moved you around so much. And this particular one, I got to stay with it from day one to now, and it was very fulfilling to see it through.
Richard, what was it about the 47 you liked the most?
I actually liked the 100 series 747 the most. I flew the 100, 200, and 400, and I found the 100 so stable, and I found that design had been what was intended for the airplane, and it just flew down an approach. You didn't have to touch anything. It was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
So that was my favorite version of the 747.
You find that, David, that pilots like certain series, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, absolutely. And Joe Sutter, Joe never, well, he officially retired from the Boeing company, but he never really left until he passed away back in 2016, but he was involved in the Dash 8, and that was one of the things he would constantly instill upon us, is that pilots love flying the 747, they love the way it lands, don't screw it up. And we had a lot of meetings with Joe, and he came from a different generation and wouldn't hold back on how he felt. But it was absolutely true. It had a huge reputation, just of its superb landing characteristics. And for the Dash 8, with all the wing changes we made, it was a huge focus of making sure that it flew just like the 747s before it, even though it had new aerodynamics. And
we were talking before about the 747-8 that was here this week. What is the biggest, we talked with the UPS people yesterday, their chief pilot, Wayne McAllister, and I'll let you explain because you'll do it better than I can, but he just said this bird is just unbelievable. Talk about the biggest change as far as the cockpit is concerned.
Oh, from a flight deck perspective. Yeah, from a flight deck perspective, it's an updated suite of displays and avionics that go with it. You know, probably the connectivity and the flight deck and with the systems is it's amazing how the technology continues to evolve and adapt. We were talking in the green room not that long ago. When we originally designed the Dash 8, we had electronic flight bags. Those were going to be the way of the future. Get rid of your bulky suitcases and go. We'll design this nifty system to hold all your charts and everything else. And before you know it, iPads came along, and that just totally changed the game. And frankly, now we don't even offer electronic flight bags on our brand new airplanes because of that. And I think that's one of our challenges as we go forward. You know, the 747, especially the Dash 8, like the airplane that's here, it's going to be flying for another 20, maybe even 30 years. So there's going to be 747s that are going to be flying well into 2050. And for me, as the chief engineer and the Boeing company, we've got to continue to look at how we improve, how we increase the safety of the airplane, make it relevant from a flight deck perspective with the latest technologies in avionics, and we'll continue to do so to make sure the Queen lives on for many, many years to come.
Well, we talked earlier about the fact that Boeing only expected to make 400.
400.
And we saw in the video you hit 1,500 in, I think,
and
2016?
And that was line number 1,554.
And it's what was the reaction at Boeing when you hit the, I mean, you work at any place, you hit a milestone, you there's a certain sense of pride, you walk a little taller and drink a little more.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, it's so I started on the 47 program right out of college in 2004, and there's no other program like it at Boeing. There's just something about it in terms of the relationship, especially with the 47. Everyone just has a deep connection with the airplane, emotional, and a lot of it has to do with just the incredible feat and the history that came with it that was mentioned in the video that we just talked about. And especially for during the Dash 8 development, you got to know the Incredibles. There were some that I worked with that were engineers that worked on the original airplane when they started at Boeing. And of course, as Joe Sutter would come into meetings to remind us not to screw up his airplane and make sure it met the expectations of everybody in the world that was going to fly it.
Troy, when you were doing the testing, did you just do the initial models, or do you, when the new series come out, you keep testing those too?
We do. We haven't had a lot of upgrades since the initial flight test. But what we did do, because it was essentially a Dash 200 cockpit in this airplane, once we finished the structural testing for the telescope, our follow-ons were upgrades. So we did a glass cockpit in it and updated that. Not quite as nice as the new Dash 800, but pretty good.